Welcome to Living with Dying, a podcast where we're going to talk about the unspeakable, everything to do with death and dying, and how to live with it. We're all on the same journey towards the end, but we just never talk about it. We don't like to think of our own life ending, and we certainly don't like to contemplate losing our nearest and dearest. So we all join in this huge conspiracy, pretending it won't happen to us. And then, when it does, we're often ill-prepared. So we're saying, let's talk about death. Let's open up the subject, and by listening to other people's stories, glean some advice and tips on how best to approach death, how to deal with loss, and how to rebuild a life after. In today's episode, we're meeting Anne, Lady Dodd, the widow of one of Britain's best-loved comedians, Ken Dodd, about how she's rebuilt her life after the death of Sir Ken 5 years ago.
I first met him about 60 years ago now, and I worked in his show. But we really got together in the 70s, so that's about coming on for 50 years. But there's something interesting every day in a good relationship. I have to say, I was never bored in my life. I've never been bored in his company.
I would imagine living with him was a lot of fun, was it? Or are comedians serious at home?
Oh, he had his serious side. I mean, he didn't run around telling jokes all day and how tickled I am. But he would see the funny side to things and life, and so that's when he'd be writing scripts in his head or ideas he wanted to work on and would want to discuss with other writers if he was doing anything for television or you want to develop something new, because you can't keep using your best bits of your act, which you hone to fix to the show. You have to have such new material all the time for television. So he'd be working on ideas. And he used to say, anyway, he used to say, I want to put 7 new gags in every night, just to make myself feel I'm working.
Did he try them out on you?
In a way he did, I suppose, but he would try them out on the audience that have already had quite a bit of a show, and given it shown that they have got chuckle muscles and they will laugh, and so he would always slip them in and write them on his hand and remind us how he could read them, just a little reminder of them. But we did do try-out shows as well. A friend used to arrange small restaurants or places where he would get together a lot of new scripts. Nobody would have to pay anything, but they might say, well, if everybody wants to put a pound in and give it to charity, you know, raise a bit of money on it. But he also did some of his own act, because he said, I'm using your goodwill to try out gags that don't always succeed. That's what a tryout is.
He seemed to have an extraordinary memory and a lot of stamina too, because he could just rattle them off, couldn't he?
He had a very fast delivery. His diction was very clear. I didn't realise till I started analysing it. How did he get so much in? Because he did have good diction. And in those days, regional accents weren't so well known or even put up with. And the BBC particularly, nowadays, you're prized if you've got a bit of accent. But in those days, BBC was very, very posh.
He was working up until he was 90. He was working up until very shortly before he died, wasn't he?
He was 90 in the November, and we were still doing shows. He did, you know, 4 or 5 shows in November. I can't remember precisely, and 3 or 4 in December. And it was bad weather. One of them had to be cancelled and moved on, but it still changed the date only by a week. And his last show was in Liverpool on the 28th December, as it happened. But they were all booked in. I mean, we had booked shows for the following year, because you don't just bring a theatre and say, can I come next week? Theatre shows would be booked sometimes a year or even 18 months in advance, some within a few months. But generally, they've got to have time to sell them, advertise them. So, yes, he loved working. It wasn't work to him.
So you can't have known that he was near the end then, can you? You both expected him to live longer.
Well, he was at 90. Um, he'd He had three or four health problems. He just dealt with them. He managed to cope with them. And if he had a show booked in, that would be the spur. It's Mr. Showbiz, isn't it? Keeps you going, makes you get on that stage and do your job. And when I said, shorter shows, longer life, do a bit shorter, because he was famous for doing very long shows. And he said, "But I'm enjoying myself." I said, "I'm only talking to myself. I'm not, it's easy." But he did enjoy it.
So you didn't really have any idea that he might die while he was doing those shows up until Christmas. Was it a bit of a shock then when it...
Well, no, he was just, as I say, he had three or four health problems he was dealing with, but he suddenly didn't feel terribly well, and he got a chest infection. We thought that's all it was, and he was getting over that, but there was a underlying virus he must have had, which of course antibiotics don't get rid of, I think that was the problem, that he didn't have the strength to fight that virus in the end. It was a shock.
And had you had any conversations previously, either of you, about what would happen, how you wanted to die, and making plans for?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I didn't even know, we'd never even discussed. I presumed he would want to do what his mother and father did, which was because they were buried. And that he would want to be, because I found out the plot they were in had four, so there were two more spaces. So I didn't know anything. No, we didn't, hadn't discussed it at all, and it's something you should have done, really, because it's a difficult time when somebody dies. You have to do so many things. A lot of things could be sorted and organised. I mean, some people are very organised, aren't they? And they know exactly what they want, what the music and what the rest of the things. I think all he ever had to do once, somebody on a BBC programme said, "What would you like as your epitaph?" And I think he said, and I can probably be proved wrong, something like, "He brought happiness and laughter," or "He shared happiness and laughter."
So you had to decide everything on his behalf, really, when it came to the funeral.
Yes.
And you had a big funeral, didn't you? And thousands of
Yes,
people
I
turned
know.
out. Tell me
What
about
it was
that.
amazing. I mean, we knew the people at the cathedral because that's where we used to worship. We used to always worship at Knotty Ash and then another place. And then we started going to the cathedral because they had a choral evensong at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which is a very good time for a service when you're working until not getting home till 5 or 6 in the morning on a Saturday night. So we had started going there. So I knew the people there. And actually, the funny thing was, the vicar at the time, the local vicar at Knotty Ash, she told me that when she first came and she did the interview and they'd accepted her, they said, "By the way, we want to make a little point," because it was just the year before Ken passed away. They said, "When you come here, you will know that we have a quite well-known resident in Knotty Ash." She says, "Oh, I know, I've met him." She said, "Well, when it comes to the funeral, we hope it's not yet, but when it does, you're not having it, we're doing it."
Oh.
Which is what they told him, the cathedral were going to do it. So I didn't have to ask. So it
Wonderful.
was rather nice that that was it.
Yes.
They said, "We're doing it," and that's it. No question, you've done, and we're organising all of it. And on the day, it went very smoothly. It was amazing. It was very well organised. And the cathedral had the choir, full choir, beautiful music. Beautiful harmonies, beautiful singing. And his favourite piece of music in his last years was the intermezzo from Cavalleria Rusticana by Mascagni. Everybody knows it, this glorious piece of music. The only one he wrote, I think. And he just liked it. I remember him listening to it in the hospital and at home. It's just a beautiful piece. The city were very good, the council were very good. They planned this route. We had a 6 mile route to get there, I think, going up here and down there, and they put it in the papers and everything. And it was lined throughout. It was just wonderful. And I'm sitting in this first car after the hearse. And at first, I thought, this is strange and sad. But then people are waving tinkling sticks. And then they're waving and smiling, and I didn't wave to begin with. And I said, "No, they want you to wave because they're going like this." So I said, "Thank you." And I thought, well, I suppose it was because he was so loved. It was amazing. It was incredible. Yes.
So you found that you were getting succour, really, from other people's...
Oh, absolutely. There is something about comfort from a lot of people. I mean, when I walked into the cathedral, the volume of people, it was a cold day, but you could feel heat from all these bodies. There were 3,000 people in the cathedral, absolutely every position taken. It's a very big cathedral. And then they had 2,000 or 3,000 outside. They'd put big screens up. I thought, I never even noticed them, but if they had it, I thought, well, there won't be people to watch that. But they were packed. They were a little bit wet, but it wasn't, didn't soak them. You know, it was just...
He was very much loved, wasn't he?
Yes, yeah.
But what was it like for you after that, when the kind of the fuss had died down and you came back here home alone?
I'm just trying to put myself back then, because it's 5 years ago. Initially, what did I do? I think, well, there was a lot of wonderful letters, wonderful, wonderful letters. And I had a card printed, and I got help writing all the addresses on the envelopes. And then I hope everybody who wrote got a reply. If they hadn't put the address, obviously they won't have had one. But, you know, if it was all illegible. So that took a few months, really. It was about June, and I was still doing it from March.
Did you find that comforting?
Yes, I think because he was a public person, in as much as everybody knew him because he was famous, and there's a line, isn't there, the kindness of strangers, I know. And that's the feeling you get. Jumping to now, as I go around this exhibition we opened a month ago, Happiness is called, at the Museum of Liverpool. I was there yesterday, dropping names, showing Miriam Margolyes around, because she used to work with him in the radio in 1970s, 60s and 70s, and has always been a very good friend. People kept sort of stopping me. Now, they don't let too many into time, it's a good flow. And people kept coming up, and one fellow put his arms around me and said, thank you so much for doing this. And everybody you meet has got a story. And this is what everybody else is telling me from the museum. And they've sent me, and I haven't had time to read them all yet, comments people have written in the visitor's book. I remember when he said, because he spoke to everyone he ever met. He loved people, he loved his audience. But going back to, no, we didn't ever discuss what he might do. So I hope he would have liked it.
So you're telling me about the exhibition which is currently on at the yes. Museum of Liverpool, which is fabulous. I was there this
Thank
morning
you.
And it is very joyful. Everywhere you turn, there's something to laugh about or
yes.
laugh with
yes.
Ken in, isn't it? But that's obviously taken you an awful lot of time to put together. And you kind of leapfrogged over the bit where you came home. You did the letters, you replied to the
yes.
letters.
Yes.
But then were you lost for a bit, or did you know
no.
immediately that you had to work on projects around Ken?
Well, by June I was sort of finishing off with the letters, and I think that was when I was approached by two people who were, it was commissioned by BBC to a television programme. They'd like to make a programme about Ken, how tickled we were. Obviously, which is rather nice play on words. And I said, that sounds a lovely idea, but I wasn't sure. They said, oh, well, we want to film you and you can do the story. Oh, I said, I don't think so. I know I was in the business. They said, oh, we've seen quite a few videos of when you were in the show here or whatever. I said, yes, but making a film, doing that, or a programme that has to be filmed, a documentary. Anyway, it worked and seemed to be well received. And after that, Tony, who was the man who actually did the filming and the work, the other chaps, the producer, you know, the director, Tony said he'd like to write a book with me. So we did. So we published The Squire of Notting Hill and His Lady. That was the book Tony Nicholson and I wrote with him. 2021, April the 1st. That was a good date. April Fool's Day. Yeah. And it's in paperback now, so must be doing right. But that was a big project. And it was good because, in actual fact, of course, COVID had started in 20. So we were doing it during COVID.
So it gave you something
to
work on.
Yes.
And did it bring you closer to Ken because you were having to doing research bits
well of... In a way, Tony did all the research. He just knew I could fill in all the bits. That was quite a good thing to get down to doing. Well, of course, I was in his show as well. I did an act in his show, so I missed all that as well. And I missed the driving around and doing the shows. I missed that as a part of the lifestyle. That's what immediately went, of course. That's right. I started doing talks.
Talks about your life?
Talks about my life in general.
Right.
The different things I'd done. Ken would be featured greatly amongst that. And I used to enjoy doing those, and because it's back on stage. And Ken used to say I was a ham. You love being on stage. You like to do your act. So he would have encouraged me to do that. So I know I have done quite a lot. And I've done only for the last few months because we've been so busy getting this exhibition together.
So it's sounding to me as if your way of handling the loss of Ken was to
keep busy.
Plunge yourself into various activities.
Yeah, well, that's right. And then because he'd already set up his Kendall Charitable Foundation, I sort of drifted into all sorts of, some of them quite big projects.
Can I bring you back to what you've learned about grief since you lost Ken? Obviously, you've kept yourself very busy, but did you manage to find ways of dealing with it? Did you have people around you? What kind of support did you find?
We got quite a big dose of different people dying in the family. I'm the last one left. And I'm quite a lot hardened to it, but I don't share it. And I don't have family to share it with. I have a couple of wonderful girls who work with me, and they've had their own losses. Like everybody has losses. Some are more dramatic because they're younger people or as a result of accidents or something like that. I've always been able to be on my own, but you can still be lonely on your own or lonely in a crowd. I don't think I was ever a really gregarious person, certainly not at school, not when I worked, when my night stopped. I didn't drink hardly. And when I was a stewardess for 12 years, you see, you'd be flying around. I was only in Europe, but everybody at night, they'd all have a drink and a quick. I might have just one or an orange, and nobody was forcing me to drink. It wasn't my cup of tea, literally. And I used to take my guitar around me with me, and when it was safe and nobody thought it was a gun, you know, you carry a little old Spanish guitar around with me. And I'd rather sit in the room learning a new piece because I'd already started doing bits of shows then with Ken when I could, you know. In the end, I was running his show in the last 20 years. I did everything because the agent had died that dealt with those. And you don't want somebody sending you up here and down there each day.
So you're describing a life where you were constantly together because you were working together,
yes,
travelling together, on stage together.
Mm.
So what was it like when suddenly that was cut off for you?
At first, it's almost that I didn't miss it because we were so busy and we were getting very tired doing it. And I think he'd started saying, and we were due a holiday, which we never got that winter. We would have had a nice break. I almost think I don't sound as though I didn't have grief. I just kept it to myself. I didn't. It's awful. I didn't need to share it. My own immediate family were gone, or my elder brother was away. My younger brother was... they were gone. There was only my elder brother left. Everybody was... They'd all died before. A lot younger than me. But so there's nobody... And Ken's own brother and sister had both passed away. We were the two odd ones left, you know, in our own families.
So you say you didn't need to share it?
Well, no.
You didn't
really
talk about
not
anything
really
with anyone?
I didn't. I have to say I didn't. I remember our vicar was very nice to talk to. She was lovely. And she was good in the last days with Ken. She hadn't known him long. But they had some good discussions because whenever we went to the cathedral, he always buttonholed somebody. I want to ask a couple of questions. It was, you know, back to the curiosity bit. And our vicar then, she was very nice. She was very good. She was very understanding.
You did mention to me earlier that you talked to him.
Oh, definitely. Well, I mean, I've said this the other day, and somebody picked it up and put something in the papers, said that I said, I've got ghosts. I never said that at all. I said, actually, I just let it that I we see it, we hear a door, the three of us, the girls and I have heard the kitchen door, and it's not windy, not the front door isn't open, there isn't another door to blow through. And we've all heard that door at different times shut. I thought, well, I thought it was already shut because otherwise the dog gets through. So we always make quite sure it is shut. And it suddenly goes to as though it's blown open and shut like that. And it's weird. I know it's nothing, and it's just, but it does make you laugh. And we laugh, and it makes me think of him. And I mean, I've been on my own when it's gone. I said, Craigie, who asked that? I said, Ken, if it's you, could you make it tell me next time? Because then I'll have a word for you. Really. I mean, I do dream about him, but
Do
you can
you?
never be sure. And you sometimes think, I think, oh, right, let's see. But I get dreams, but he disappears at the end. And when you wake up from it, you don't want to, because but they're generally to do with the work we had to do, shows and getting them on. But you know how dreams are, go like that. So whereas I'd be getting on stage and everything there, I'd not be in the right costume, or I'd be visible and I'm backstage and I'm not dressed at all for this part, and I've not done this, I've not done this. It would be wrong, something would be going wrong. It's extraordinary how your brain puts these things together, but they're quite possible. And when you dream them, you're so sure. And I've had quite a few when I thought, oh, that's awful, what's happened? It's all gone wrong. And I wake up in bed and I think, where am I going to? Oh my gosh, thank God it's a dream. Oh, I've had it absolutely
So
physically.
that's upsetting.
Well, because no, you're grateful it's a dream. I used to have a recurring one of driving up a hill, and then you've got to get down this terribly narrow, and it gets narrower and narrower, and the wheel's actually going over the edge. That's when I wake up, because you're never going to get down. It goes narrower and narrower, and your car's going. Oh. Yes, terrible dreams. But the best sleep I get is if I watch television late. I let the dog come in and watch with me, because I might have been out for the night doing something, whatever, or working, or doing things. And I might have left him locked up for a few hours. And he's got the kitchen and his food, but he likes to be with you. So I'll go, oh, come on, then we'll watch television. Oh, and he shoots in there and sits in his bed and thing. And he likes to just be with you. And I should be better. He's my comfort. Yes, now you. That he is my comfort. That's true. That's why I get a great comfort, because Ken knew him and loved him.
And I think you did tell me that you share sort of little moments
Oh,
with
gosh,
him.
yeah. I mean, well, I don't know what you think. I've got to do this thing. Well, you're not really imagining he's there listening, but I have actually thought, what would he do about this, or how would he approach this? And I can tell it's not him telling me not to, but nobody can say it isn't. It's really your own mind knowing, because you know him that well, he would say this, this, and this, and you're obeying that because you think, yes, he's quite right.
You know
But it's
what
your
he.
mind telling you that's what he would say about this project you're doing,
And you're able to say
and
that
I'm able to
because
say that because I know from experience that's what he would do.
you him
Yes,
so
that's
well.
very true. That is true. I do things, and I'm even silly little things, silly things. I talk to him. I refer to him.
I find still that it's the little tiny things that happen on a daily basis, things that aren't significant or important, and things that you couldn't possibly ring up somebody else to tell them about. But it's a little thing that you would have shared. You would have gone into the room and you said, "Oh, you never guess what I've just done." Or,
Yes.
as I say, insignificant things. But having someone to share those with, it's hard when you can't.
You're right. Certainly, when I'm driving, I can really feel him pulling me back sometimes. You're going too fast, you're going too fast. Not that he's actually saying it, it's just that I know that's what he would say.
There's the saying, isn't there, that grief is the price we pay for love.
Yes.
Do you have a view on that?
Oh, it's absolutely true, isn't it? I mean, I'm so grateful to have had this love of my life when that person is no longer there. I mean, I look at his picture every night, and every morning he's there. And the last thing I do before I turn the light out, if I switch it, and it's a little button thing, and it goes off before, I've got to switch it on again to make sure the very last thing I see is his face. And he used to get people would actually, there's another way of people getting the grief sorting the groove, is telling somebody else you don't know all about it. Because people would tell Ken their stories, and so often it was about having lost somebody and didn't want to come to a show again, but I've been brought to this and he's brought, you've made me want to live again, which is wonderful. But he, Ken's way with people was to encourage them to talk. He was always curious about people. And before you knew where he was, he's got the life story of half a dozen people at the stage doors, and it's really, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. But he's so interested, and people want to tell him. But I think sharing grief with a stranger is good because they'll actually let it pour out, that they might be embarrassed because it might upset the person they're telling. And I think that's another way of doing it. And that's perhaps why I say it to the wall, you know, at the famous play. Yeah, I don't put talk about grief. No, I definitely don't. But I do to him or in interviews. I'm surprised at myself when I can't say that. And I can get emotional listening to other sad stories. But I don't cry about my own. Except certain instances, you know, a bit of music. Or the one thing that really, really upset me after he died was we had an answer phone. This was just an ordinary BT phone that actually takes messages as well. And you just press buttons and it's there. He would ring at night. I'd come home to check things out. And it might be 1 o'clock in the morning. He would ring, "Are you coming back to the hospital, you know?" And so there was a message there. "Are you coming, Annie? Are you there? Are you there?" And I'd hear it because I know it clicks into messages. So he'd say, Annie, are you there? Annie, are you coming back? Waiting to see you. All right, take care. Drive carefully. I'm only going around the corner. This was him calling me to come and see him. "Are you coming, Annie?" You know, I was so heartbroken about that. Burst out crying about that. I was really, really upset about that. If I had to really say why I feel I've coped with grief, is that I've kept myself just so busy that I haven't had time to grieve. And the grieving I do are sometimes the most happy moments because I keep seeing pictures of him in programmes that come up. The sad ones are if you look at a photograph of a holiday or something you've been, because that was real life together. But watching him on a screen, it's rather nice and warm. And also it's when he was young and vibrant and fit and at full throttle, as a friend of mine wrote in his newspaper once in an article. He said, "Nothing like Ken Dodd at full throttle, delivering them gags." So that's easy. I can watch his programmes and don't feel upset at all. Well, I think I wish he was here now, which you always wish. But the ones that make me sad is when you, I've got hundreds of boxes of photographs I really should look through, but they do make me sad. So I don't see the point of making yourself sad.
You've had an awful lot of sorting out to do, haven't you? And some people don't like doing that. Some people put that off.
Yes, I have. Well, I have things. It's lovely to see certain things. I let them have his coat and hat and scarf that I can see him in now, and it's been hanging in my hall for the 5 years since he's gone. There are certainly, so they're now in the museum, actually, behind the inner corner, things so nobody can touch them. I would say follow your instinct. If you want to talk to somebody and need to talk to somebody, if it's easier to do it with a friend, or do it to a complete stranger. There must be so many ways of dealing with grief. I don't know if I've been much help at all, but for me, it has been keeping very busy. And because he was a public figure, I feel as though everybody owned him a bit. But he was mine, really.
Thank you, Lady Dodd, for sharing your story with us. And if anyone would like to visit Happiness, the exhibition about Ken Dodd's life and art, it's on at the Museum of Liverpool until the 3rd of March. We'll be having more chats in future episodes about everything to do with death and dying, such as how to prepare for it, what it's really like when someone dies, how to talk about it, what kind of plans to make, how different cultures and faiths approach dying and bereavement, lots more around grief and loss, how to support others in their sadness, and my personal hobby horse, how to rebuild a life, a good life, after the loss of someone special. If you'd like to join us to talk about the death of someone near to you, if this episode has resonated with you and you have a story to share, or if you've been affected by some of the issues raised, please do get in touch at hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.